everybody. Welcome to episode 78 of the Alexis Ale podcast. And hi, Talal. How are you doing today?
Hey, Alexia. Woo. I'm okay. Thank you. Woohoo! It's hot and sunny here in sunny South London. This tarmac is melting on the streets, sticking to people's tires. And
traffic is backing up on the I-50. There's reports of a bank robbery in the corner of Wilshire Boulevard.
Remember, people, keep your cool out there on the streets.
Hey,
don't let
cool.
the heat get to your head.
Don't push me because I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Yeah, it reminds me of fucking Mr. Leveson, my politics teacher.
Well, he used to rap. Form.
He used to think it was very funny. He'd randomly, he was not a funny guy, and he was a very dry.
Yeah,
it's his teaching persona. I'm sure with him among his friends, he was the laugh of the group. But he was very dry and very strict, and he hated me. And for no reason, he just decided I was the guy in the class.
He always got fun. Yeah,
and. But every now and then he'd be in the middle of talking about Thatcher or something, and then he'll just say, "Don't push me because I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my." And he's like, thought it was a hilarious joke. All the other kids were like, "Ah, oh, you're a riot, Mr. Leveson. That's so good." And I'm sitting there going, "What fucking douchebag?" But yeah, I hated him. All my mates loved him, but because he chose me as his example, he'd make an example of me every class.
Well, the entire teaching staff at my school did that with me, so
yeah,
count yourself lucky. It was only
were you at school?
Quite rightly, you know, I mean, they were right to pick on me.
Well, I was a bit of a joker,
now we're getting to it.
I'd make quips and stuff, but most teachers loved me, they thought I was hilarious and charming.
Did they?
Yeah,
all the teachers hated me.
Were you at school at a time when they would use the cane?
They did, yeah, but they were all too frightened of my mother to ever use it on me. I never got that. They were far too scared of Molly too.
Oh, did she ever go in and bollock them?
Oh, she'd go, yeah. You imagine if they caned her, Lexi. But yeah, they did. I mean, I can't remember. It wasn't very, I mean, people of my generation, particularly if they went to Catholic school, I think, you know, the some of them had their lives ruined by the brutality that was handed out to them.
Yeah.
I don't think it was too bad at our school, really, but, you know, still wrong, obviously profoundly wrong. But no, they'd never.
This whole idea, I'm doing it for your own good. This is for your own good. This hurts me more than it hurts you.
Yeah,
your parents too. Like now, it's unheard of, pretty much, to like hit your kids.
Yeah, yeah.
A little spanking.
Yeah, yeah.
That used to be a way of showing love and discipline. To beat your child and make them hostages in their own home.
That's the theory. Yeah, but no, they were always too frightened of my mother to ever discipline me. I mean, obviously they told me not to come back, but halfway through the sixth form. But again, I forgive them for that. They were right. I was a you know, thorn in their side, really.
What breed of naughty were you? What brand of naughty?
Oh, like, I was
starting fights or
no, not really. I didn't. I stopped sort of wearing. I mean, it was minor shit, really. I mean, I remember reading a list of, you know, infractions in U.S. high school. In the 50s, you know, compared to, say, the 90s. And in the 50s, it was, you know, chewing gum or running in the hall. And then in the 90s, it was like bringing an assault rifle to school or, or dealing crack or, you know what I mean? So it was standard. So it was, you know, I had long hair and a beard and I said sarky. Well, you know, there was this thing. I mean, it's probably an early lesson in how hollow bourgeois democracy is. But they decided to bring in this kind of school council, and each class would send a representative. And my class elected me. And so they made them re-hold the election twice until the electorate got the idea. Yeah.
That, so you were a man of the people. The people.
Yeah, I was popular. You know,
they were afraid of you.
They were afraid of me. Yeah, yeah.
Did you used to write revolutionary slogans on the walls of the changing rooms and stuff?
I can't. I mean, it's hard to know. I think, you know, my crimes were pretty minor by the standards of today, but
I'm not getting any specifics out of you.
I can't remember really. It was just a sort of generalized attitude, having long hair and a beard and not wearing the school tie and stuff like that, and getting there late and generally lounging around and sneering. But of course, they could have, everybody in the sixth form was made a prefect apart from me as well. But if they'd just realized, you know, I was acting out probably, that if they'd encouraged my rebelliousness, I would have been their disciple then, and I would have become a slave to authority and would now be a Labour Party councillor in Walton and Liverpool. You know, it was partly because they opposed my free spirit that made me increasingly, you know, double down on it. Yeah. You know, if they tried to incorporate me, I think I probably would have.
It's true. Love is always the answer.
And if they'd made me a prefect, I would have been. I probably would have been the most efficient. You know, I would have turned into like Oberfuhrer, Oberst-Lieutenant. Say already, I probably would become the most enthusiastic member of the prefect staff.
Yeah,
of course they didn't realise that. Which brings us to our film Mephisto, I suppose.
Mephisto. We can we could jump straight into Mephisto.
We normally warm up to it,
but that was a good transition.
Yeah,
indeed.
That's why I'm a top DJ with my own show on.
Yeah.
Radio Barrow Inferness.
Alexi Segway Sale. Mephisto was our film club film for this month.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
I just thought of a story there just before.
Okay.
I think when I still had my old Rover, my P5B coupe. And we'd either gone to pick my mother up in on Christmas Day. We'd either taking my mother back to Liverpool or bringing her from Liverpool to London to spend the remainder of that. And the traffic was bad on the M1, and we came off and went through Coventry, and I had the local Coventry station on. And they said, in a few minutes, we've got Alexi Sale coming in for an interview. I mean, what they were in fact doing was just playing tapes of, you know, people who'd been interviewed that year, I think. You know, they were just, but they didn't say that. They're just playing tapes. So I thought, I was actually quite near the radio station at that point because we'd come off. So I could have driven to the radio station and then said, I'm here for my interview.
That's so trippy.
they would have panicked, really. Yeah.
So, what were you promoting? Was that as early as CAC days? Were you promoting?
Must
CAC?
Have been in. I was probably a tour, you know, because I was touring sort of 82, 83, 84. If I had the Rover, it must have been between 84 and 88. So.
How many tours have you done?
I have no idea. They're all very, very short. I mean, the number of live dates that I've done in my life would probably be what Stuart Lee does in a month or something. Right. I mean, I never really loved the. I wish I had like. I mean, never really loved the life really, of touring and doing live stand up. So, very. I mean, I would do. I mean, once I was on the telly, I would do 30, 40 dates a year, kind of thing. You know. So
would it be a whole new set every year?
No. I mean, Stuart. I mean, I don't know when that came in. Really. I mean, what I used to do was start off with a set and then it sort of evolve, and so it became substantially different. But
There'd still be nuggets of like.
There'd still your be first yeah. Or right. Or, I mean, right until the end, I would be doing. I mean, because I think that. I mean, that's a closer thing to old style kind of vaudeville where you kept the same act forever. Really, I mean, it's people. I mean, Stewart's generation probably started doing that entire new show every year or a couple of years. Really, which just seems like a bit of a pain in the arse. Really. I mean, I was doing Hello, John Got New Motor. You know, from when I started in like big venues in 82 or something, 81, to when I stopped in 96. Of course, by then I was very bitter about doing Hello, John Got New Motor. I would say things like, you know, I'm fucking sick of this song. I'm fucking sick of this song. Hello, John Got New Motor. Hello, you know.
Which I'm sure the audience thought was just a brilliant.
Yeah, they were quite. Yeah, they were. Well, yeah. But so I mean there is an argument to be made for it. The show over time changed, and so there was very little that was, but there were bits that were there. And
do you perform that song now?
No, I'm just trying to think if I can. You know, some of the material you have to. There's a bit where I used to do. I pretend to cough, and then I'd say, I've got a bit of a frog in my throat. I've been giving a blowjob to Charles Aznavour. That's all right, isn't it, to say that?
Who's that?
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, after a while, I just updated it and changed it to Gerard Depardieu.
I thought you were going to say Kermit the Frog or something.
No, frog. Well, it's a frog.
A French person.
Yeah, it's racist, isn't it? I'm getting a bit of frog in my throat. I've been given, and that's all I did was update it. Once nobody knew Charles Aznavour was.
Gerard Depardieu.
I changed it to Gerard Depardieu, yeah. And then I said, I've been sucking a fisherman's friend all day, I would say. I know, there was bits of me that were really quite old school. But that was my one gesture to, you know, kind of modernity was I changed Charles Aznavour to Gerard Depardieu.
Now, on your
sketch
show, you had those monologue segments.
Yes.
Which were essentially stand-up. Was that material you would do live?
Mostly, yeah.
It was?
Yeah. I mean, in the early series, yeah, it was all taken from the live show.
Taken from the live show, okay. Yeah. But you also had, like, co-writers on the sketch shows.
Yes. David Rennick, Andrew Marshall, and then Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews. Yeah.
Would they help you write live material as well?
By and large, they didn't. Sometimes they would write the monologues. Sometimes, generally, they wrote the sketches and I wrote the monologues.
Right.
That's how it broke down. So, you know.
And
so
you never bought. Did you ever buy jokes off people?
No. I mean, I would have done if anybody could have written them. You know. I had some writers whose work I used. I mean. Guy called Dennis Burson, who's dead now, and he used to be a joke writer for Ken Dodd and stuff like that. But he liked me, and he would he gave me the odd or I bought the odd gag. And David Stafford, who I wrote with, I wrote like my award winning radio series for Capital Radio. I would use some of the stuff, the mime routine, for instance. That was David. It was a tirade about mime, you know, that if you, it was really good. I mean, I did it on Secret Police. You know, people, that's when I had the row with Jesper Carrot about the use of the word Guildford. If a real man, you know, sewed his fingers together or walked into the wind or I can't remember what else. You know, you wouldn't. But if a man pretends to sew his fingers together, you know, and walk into a wall, people travel from Guildford to see him. And
what was Jesper Carrot's problem with the word Guildford?
I'd also had a gag. I can't remember what it was now that ended in Guildford. And we had this row about who was going to say Guildford. And I said, well, who's on first? And he said, you are. I said, well, fuck you. I'm doing it then.
Yeah.
So I used Guildford. And then he changed his gag to Basingstoke and it died on its arse.
why is Guildford funnier?
I don't know. That's the magic of comedy that you have to. That's what you get the big books for, is knowing that Guildford is funnier than Basingstoke. Wow. Although, interestingly enough, I had a friend who was a writer, who was at Merseyside Youth Theatre with, who was a writer on Brookside, and they had a family, I can't remember, they had a family move out, you know, in the way that they, you know, they would be replaced. So they decided to send them to the most unscoused place that there was in Britain, which was Basingstoke. So anyway, this family, let's call them the Mulrooney family, moved to Basingstoke. And occasionally, you know, people would say to other characters, you know, I wonder how John and Pat are getting on in Basingstoke. Have you heard anything from Basingstoke, from John and Pat and the kids in Basingstoke? There's a place where there are, you would imagine there are no scousers, really.
Basingstoke. Oh, it'd be great if they had an episode, like one episode that was just them in Basingstoke. Yeah. Losing their minds.
A spin-off, yeah. Basingstoke, looking for other scousers.
Yeah.
Basingstoke.
They find like a secret club of them in the basement and under a church.
When I did that documentary about Liverpool in 2007, they had a clip from Brookside because I interviewed Frank Cotterill Boyd. And, God, it was boring. I mean, it was Ricky Tomlinson and Sheila Johnson. And they were talking about, she said, so what's happening with the industrial dispute, Ricky? And he said, well, they've called ACAS in now, so it's going to arbitration. And it was just like a kind of dramatization of TUC conference. It was unbelievably boring. Then later on it got saucier, didn't it? And television's first lesbian kiss. Or did it? And they'd started having bodies buried under the patio. I just got killed him with a shovel because of his composite motion to the National Union of Miners conference in Basingstoke. We've got a long way from Mephisto, haven't we, really?
Someone asked in the Patreon chat questions for Alexi chat room.
Yeah.
By the way, support the show, please. Go to patreon.com/AlexiCell podcast.
You've got a lovely voice.
That's patreon.com/AlexiCell podcast to support the show. A few pounds a month will help keep this show going. For the price of a salt lick a month. Someone asks, Paul asks, he's rereading Thatcher Stole My Mitches.
Yes.
And having walked past the Bedford Arms hundreds of times.
Yeah.
Never once have I been tempted to enter the premises.
No.
Are there any other pubs that Alexi used to frequent in Fulham that he should probably walk past?
Well, the Bedford was the main one. There was a pub on the other... over more towards Baron's Court, I remember. Remember going there with Harry for having a drink, and there was a family sitting outside in a Volkswagen camper van. And so we started talking to them. It turned out they'd been barred out. It's called like the Cherry Tree or something, I think, the pub. And they'd been barred out from the pub.
What area? Sorry.
Sort of. It was north towards like West Kensington. I can't remember what that area is called, really, Baron's Court. So it was sort of north and slightly east of where we were. And maybe the pub was called the Pear Tree. Anyway, there was this family sitting in the back of this, and they'd been barred out from the pub, but the management allowed them to park a VW camper van outside and then buy pints and then sit in their VW camper van drinking them.
The Pear Tree is in Baron's Court.
Yeah, it's still there.
Did it look like that?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it probably serves, you know.
Yeah, it looks like it's been done up.
Yeah, it serves, you know.
Mitchell and Butler's pub now.
Oh, really?
No, probably, I'm assuming.
Oh, right. But yeah, probably, you know, it's been taken over by some aristocrats who serve Tamil food.
So they allowed them to sit in their camper van and
outside. Yeah, outside the pub.
Well, that's,
you know, which I suppose
it
was a reasonable compromise, really, wasn't it? In a sense, because the pub still got the revenue, but didn't have to put up with this.
Probably just out of persistence, they probably just kept showing up, and they're like, "For fuck's sake!"
Yeah.
It took effort to keep Barrett kicking them out.
Yeah. I remember doing these book reading tours I used to do. It could be very shonky, really. I always got well paid for some reason. I remember doing a place in Hull. And there wasn't much of a stage, and there was a couch on it, and there was a family sitting on the couch. And they said, we've been barred from this pub or bar or whatever it was for 6 months, and we're celebrating. They've just taken off our, we're allowed back in, and we're just celebrating. So these people were sitting on a couch on the stage with me. I just incorporated them into the act, really. But you can't imagine that a lot of authors would have reacted to that, really. So I suppose
that's Simon a big Armitage, deal.
He would have been.
It's a milestone day for them.
It was. It was their big day.
They were honoured.
Yeah.
To have you mention them as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a welcome back. Someone asked, Michael asked, have you ever seen the Liverpool set Albert Finney film Gumshoe?
Now you've got, yeah, well, not only have I seen it, but I'm also sort of am friends with several other people involved in it. A few years ago,
contains traces of Maureen Lipman, he says, trigger warning.
Yeah, health warning, yeah.
A few years ago,
I remember I don't know why I did it. I mean, it was my favourite film, and it was at a cinema must have been organised by the BFI or something. It was in central London. I chose as my film Gumshoe. And I think Gumshoe is really interesting for several reasons. It's actually written by a Liverpool writer, again, Catholic, called Neville Smith, who we were friendly with for a while. He was a contemporary of Bleasdale and Willie Russell and all those people, but I thought he had more to him in a way, Neville. I mean, he was a complicated guy, really, and had a lot of demons, but the posse or the community can, I think it's about a sort of club comic played by Albert Finney, who's obsessed with Sam Spade, the creator, the Dashiell Hammett, really. And I think it actually, that idea, and Sam Spade actually appears to him and gives him advice. I think
fictional detective character?
Yes, Dashiell Hammett was the great post-war kind of noir writer of detective.
British?
Fiction. Dashiell Hammett, no, American.
American.
I mean, he's Sam Spade. Is he post-war? It might be. Sam Spade. Raymond Chandler was British.
Raymond Chandler's American, surely.
No, he's British.
But all his books are set in America.
They are, but he was British.
I did not know. That's my noir guy. I love Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, but they were all set in Los Angeles. The Philip Marlowe books are set in Los Angeles. Yeah. Dashiell Hammett's Sam Spade was San Francisco. I mean, still West Coast United States, but sort of a different milieu. And one is Chandler is pre-war. Both of them, of course, all of them played by Humphrey Bogart.
Oh, Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, it was.
That's from 1929.
Oh, shit. So it's the book. Dashiell Hammett is pre-war then, and Chandler is post-war, right?
I think so, yes.
Anyway,
Chandler's
so,
definitely post-war.
But
yeah.
Woody Allen did this film called Play It Again, Sam, in which the ghost of Sam Spade appears to him. And I think Neville's film actually predates it. It's also interesting because the first film directed by Stephen Frears, my friend Stephen Frears, probably Britain's most successful film director in many ways. And it's just a really interesting film. It's also a view of Liverpool in the 70s, that kind of period of economic collapse.
Yeah,
and it's a really interesting. I talked about it. I tried to get Neville to come along. He wouldn't really. I think he's become.
We spoke a few episodes ago about the demolishing of like half of Liverpool.
Yeah,
and this documents that.
It's certainly set in that milieu. Yeah, it's also got. I've got the bin men outside. Are you hearing that? I think it's the bin men.
I'm hearing only hearing a load of rubbish coming out of your mouth, Lex. Hey. No, I can't hear that. This looks great. I've never heard of this film. I love noir. I'm a bit of a noir fan. I love the Raymond Chandler books. I love the old noir films, and I even like the remake of The Long Kiss Goodnight with Ross and Monica's dad from Friends. What's his bloody name?
Elliot Gould. It's directed by Robert Altman, isn't it?
It's an Altman film.
I didn't like it at the time, but that might have been me being overly censorious.
It's not great, but I like it because of the Altman, the Altmanicity of it.
Yeah.
Because it's so weird to have a film noir with the Robert Altman style where everyone's just talking at the same time and these really long drawn out shots. It was a subversion of the genre, which I appreciated.
Right. Because, okay.
Yeah, it doesn't use many of the cliches of film noir.
But, Robert.
My question is Gumshoe. Oh, yeah. Sorry,
well,
go
we
on.
Could, what, yeah, I mean,
the
I'm,
real.
I'm,
no, no, the Altman. What were you going to say about Altman?
No, which just really? It's weird because he also did, of course, Gosford Park, which is, you know, a sort of the pilot episode of Downton Abbey, really.
Oh.
And he also did a marvelous film called Shortcuts, which is based on the short stories of, oh, shit, one of my favorite authors whose name I have forgotten.
I think I've seen Shortcuts, yeah.
Tell me who it is. What we talk about when we talk about love, the author, what's his name? Alcoholic. Raymond Carver.
I just read you that don't name need, yeah, as Raymond you Carver. Said it.
I mean, a film that I found stunning when I first saw it, really.
My question is about Gumshoe. Is it, because it says it's a black comedy, is it a parody of film noir or is it a film noir like, in its style, in its shooting style? And has it got like voiceover?
Well, I think it's a tribute to, and it also is actually, it's a murder mystery.
Yeah.
So it's an evocation. It's not a parody of. Well, it's a complicated film, really. I mean, it's about a murder. It's a kind of noir-esque mystery, but on the other end, the central protagonist is a Liverpool club comic, you know. So I think it's an interesting blending of genre, really. I think it was really a very interesting film. And I think because Bleasdale was more of a kind of self-publicist in a way, and that Neville really got the attention, and probably sabotaged himself, really. But Neville really didn't get the attention he deserved, I think. I tried to sort of promote him, but he also wouldn't. It wouldn't be helped in some ways. He was very close to. He was very good friends with Alan Bennett. Neville and is in some of Alan Bennett's films. But yeah, I suppose it's shot on 35mm. It looks quite murky, really. And Stephen Frears was amazingly young when he did it, and then didn't do another movie for years, really. And then after that, went got back into movies with a Terrence Stamp movie called The Hit set in Spain, and then of course had the huge long string of massive successes.
When he made it.
Eh?
He was 30 years old when he made it.
Stephen, was he?
Yeah.
God, he's old.
He was born in 1941.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's older than my dad.
Yeah. I'm still going, still working,
It's delightfully funny, more so because it never indulges in obvious pastiche. Instead, filtering its many echoes of the 40s thrillers through the pop-tinted glasses of the Presley 50s, as well as the sober horn rims of reality. That was the monthly film bulletin.
Review. Yeah. Actually, Neville's in it as well. Neville is in it when he... Albert Finney character gets left given a gun by an anonymous and Neville.
Oh, makes a cameo.
Predictably on a patch of wasteland, which is what most of Liverpool was at that point. Neville tells him about you know.
It says the lead character was a bingo caller, not a
yes.
comic, but I guess there's
an aspiring
thing, line there.
Be a comic, yeah.
Right, okay. Looks
it's
sick.
Got Frank Finlay, Albert Finney, month. Billy Whitelaw.
I'd be well up for watching that. Well, speaking of movies, shall we? Shall we dive into our discussion?
Yes.
This month's edition of the Alexi Sale Film Club.
Film Club. Who's the leader of the gang that's great for you and me?
Alexi Sale.
We love to hear him swear on the TV.
You fat bastard.
Everybody gives the cheers except the BBC. Yes, who's that fat bastard?
Fat bastard. Mephisto. I wrote a little intro. Would you like to hear it?
Yeah.
Your favourite part of Alexi Sale's Film Club. All right, Alexi Sale Film Club. No, Mephisto, 1981. Hendrik Hofgen is the darling of Hamburg's revolutionary Bolshevik theatre scene. With ambitions of greatness, he cannot resist the invitation to join Berlin's State Theatre, even though it means having to start again from the bottom. However, his talent is undeniable and he rockets to stardom once more. Meanwhile, the Nazi Party slowly take hold of Germany before winning the election. Many emigrate, many disappear, many are killed as censorship and dictatorship firm their grip of the country. As Hendrik's fame and riches grow, his close friends, a distant memory, will he keep acting the part? Or will he risk his life and speak his truth to power? Mephisto, 1981.
Yeah, well, that? I mean, once I got into it, I mean, you have to get over a certain stylistical kind of, you made it seem a lot more linear than it is in a way that you have to deduce what's happening. I mean, it's difficult when a film's in translation, you don't know how plodding or how clever the translation is, you know, so.
Apparently was edited down quite severely as well.
Really? Jesus Christ.
It was originally a lot longer.
Really?
Over 3 hours, yeah.
Yikes. I mean, I think it's long enough as it is, really.
2 hours, 20-minute runtime.
Yeah.
I think the film was linear, so I don't know what you mean by that. It wasn't like Tarantino-ing around and jumping back and forth in time.
Well, there's those sort of bits where you see characters, for instance, presumably talking to him, but he's not. You don't see him, for instance. And then... I don't know. It could be the translation to a degree, but it's not. It's not like there's no like. Oh, now I'm going to move to the Berlin. Yeah, I mean, you made it seem more. You know, he doesn't say. Now I'm moving to the Berlin State Theater, even though I'm big. You know, it's sort of told in a more oblique way than that. It's not a criticism. I'm just saying that it's more.
Yeah,
oblique.
It's the things that. Yeah, that was a punchy. Synopsis, but
yeah.
Things just seem to happen and roll into one another. It's not everything is signposted as if it was like a Brechtian thing.
No.
But we do see the film covers the journey of this actor who's like a small local revolutionary theater guy. And slowly the country is being taken over by the Nazi party, and you also see a human being taken over by the Nazis. And he rockets to fame, but at the great expense of his soul, basically, right?
Yes, and it was, I think, heart-stopping to watch it now. I think you would have, if one had watched that film a couple of years ago, you would have just seen it as a kind of a historical piece. But now there are so many echoes, I think, with what we are living through right now.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Growing authoritarianism specifically.
That kept me going through the film.
Yeah. It's extraordinary, you know, and terrifying, really. One of the sort of sad things, in a way, is that the United States in the film is a place that people can flee to, you know, from the Nazis. Whereas now, of course, the United States, where would you flee to now? You know, the United States is the source of, is Nazi Germany or is becoming that? There's nowhere to run anymore, really. Portugal.
Where would you run? Right, Spain. Ireland,
I suppose, yeah.
Portugal and Spain are good shouts as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to learn a new language.
Yeah.
Antarctica. It's the only place free of any.
Maybe you could hide in plain sight. Maybe I could. There's an interesting article in Squawk Box today about sexual child abuse in illegal West Bank settlements. And it says, they are a good place. If you're a criminal of one kind or another, then presumably you have to be Jewish as well. If you flee to an illegal West Bank settlement, it's, you're untouchable.
Yeah.
So maybe I could flee to...
Israel has done that a number of times, harbored criminals, because just for the sake of population.
I mean, I think there is a lot of organized crime in Israel as well, or emanates from Israel. There would be, if you think about it. Maybe I could go there.
You could, yeah.
Yeah, I could pretend. Yeah, you can't. No. But
could forge me some documents, maybe.
I could pretend to, I've had a late life conversion. His dancing, I find out, to take in some sometimes. But
there's that scene early on. He's with, thought it was his dance instructor, but it's his girlfriend, or is she both?
I think she's a dance instructor as well, I assume. Yeah.
She seems to be his movement teacher, in a way. But then they start shagging.
Yeah.
But he does really
bloody hell, kind that's of bad.
That jazz dancing. Bad. But then when you see him on stage,
it works,
it's insane. He does this Russian dance performance.
Yeah.
And I don't know, he's wearing a massive beard on his face, so I don't know if it's a stunt dancer they got in there.
I don't know.
It was brilliant performance. Yeah. His movement
and
works.
There is a thing in that he does do some sort of jazz dancing in one of the cabarets he's doing, and actually it does sort of work when he does it on stage, really.
I want to focus in on that. The early bits of the film, before the Nazi stuff happens, he is... the director of a Bolshevik revolutionary theater group in Hanover, and they never say the word Brecht. Hamburg, excuse me. They never say the word Brecht, but I'm pretty sure they're doing Brechtian theater.
Yes.
You even see a character with his name on his t-shirt. He's wearing a shirt with his character's name on it, which was a... And so, yeah, I was like, is that why Alexei pick the film? How much did that resonate with you? Or is that the kind of Brechtian theatre you love? Because I know you're a fan of Brecht. Was it a Brecht pastiche they were doing at the beginning?
No, I think it was just the sort of thing that would have been going on in Germany at that time, really.
Right.
I think the reason I chose it is because it's a parable for the times we live in, that when you see these, the fucking people fawning around Trump. And, people are focusing on the Western media, as it will do, missing the real story, focusing on the tariffs and so on, but just missing out on the rampant kind of authoritarianism which is taking over the United States. You know, a country which has always at least pretended to revere free speech, and now people are being fired. Obviously the canary in the coal mine is...
Deported.
The canary in the coal mine is pro-Palestinians, but, it's a cliche to quote the Pastor Neil Muller poem, but it is, the reason it's a cliche is because it's endlessly true, First they came for the communists, but I did not protest because I was not a communist. Mm. First they came for the pro-Palestinians. But I did not, it has resonance because it absolutely
tells a
true story,
You see that very on the nose when we introduce to the Nazi prime minister character.
He's very good. He's fantastic. Very good. Amazing, a great actor. I don't know who he is, and amazingly well written as well. That switching from kind of that the way he grabs Kraus Maria Brandau by the neck, the scruff of the neck at one point and stuff like that, the kind of overly intimate physicality and then the switching between aggression and...
Well, that comes at the very end. The whole...
Extraordinary.
For most of the film, he's just like, he's his new... he goes to see Hendrik in the theater and loves his performance. But from the very beginning, Hendrik, we can tell that Hendrik is holding his tongue and being weak around him and sucking up to him, fawning over him. And you can see the implied threat, and you can see that everyone basically does that. And like, there's a wedding happening, and then they're like, the prime minister's here, and everyone kind of freezes up, and he walks in, and everyone pretends to be very polite, but you can see the tension. And
fantastically then one of the greatest scenes, when halfway through the later production of Mephisto, when he calls him to his box, and so the audience starts, Mephisto in his white face is talking to the prime minister in his box, and the audience start looking up, because it's the devil talking to the prime minister of Germany, you know. And it's like, it's a heart-stopping scene. It's very powerful, I think.
Wow, yeah. I didn't even fucking connect that. So all this is like kind of unsaid tension and fear, and everyone's just being so nice and praising of this prime minister. And obviously on the sidelines, people are being disappeared and arrested. But then at the end of the film, Mephisto, Hendrik asks him for one more favor, one favor too many.
Yeah.
And he completely flips out, and you actually see the actual aggression.
Yeah.
And he just screams it into him and says, get the fuck out, you know, don't fucking ask me about favors anymore. Get the fuck out of here. Which we haven't seen up until then, the actual face-to-face aggression of the Nazis. And then the next time we see him, the last time we see them, back to being friendly and nice.
Yeah. And then I think when they walk, they force him to walk out in front of those kind of spotlights. I think I assume they're wanting him to kind of, hold some kind of Nuremberg rally for them. And he just says to the camera, does he, well, I'm just an actor. What do they want of me? Ich bin ein Schauspieler.
I'm just an actor. That's the ending of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
So they've given him the finale of the film is that they show him this humongous amphitheater.
Yeah.
And he basically says, this is your next stage. Like,
yeah,
we thought he was at the top already, but now he's being offered like the biggest stage in Germany.
Yeah.
And you can see him like trembling and sweating.
Yeah. But
he
truly
goes, go on, try it. Get out there, try it. And he starts, he walks out into it, and they put these spotlights on it, and he's trying to run out of the spotlight.
Yeah.
It's because the whole film he's been chasing the fucking spotlight, and then at the end he's trying to run out of it, and they're following him around.
Yeah,
and he looks terrified. It's kind of the "what have I become" moment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're seeing some celebrities finally kind of speak out and turn coat against their Zionist whispers in their ears. Do you think, how many people out there are having their "what have I become"?
Yes, moment? Well, unfortunately not enough, but you know.
I was really, I really enjoyed watching White Lotus with my girlfriend. Finale, we really loved it. And then we saw some interviews after the finale. I saw some stuff on Instagram, interviews with the cast, and Jason Isaacs was wearing wearing the yellow ribbon thing and all the press stuff. None of the other cast were wearing it. And then you hear stories that he had gossiped about there being tension on set, and some people didn't get on and stuff. And it's because he's a Zionist fuckhead.
Yeah, pro-Zionist shitbag. Yes, indeed. I didn't like White Lotus at all, and I loved series 2. I thought it was awful.
I indulged in the slow nothingness of it, you know. It was really slow, but it's so pretty to look at. I thought that it's human relationships written quite well, especially the three ladies storyline. I liked it a lot. And I thought the performances were really cool.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I know it's a divisive show. Best displayed right here on the Alexis Tell podcast. 50% of this podcast hated it. 50% of us loved it.
Yeah.
But I guess if you're sitting with someone watching a show and you both start off going, oh, this is great, this is great, and you both just start agreeing with each other, you convince yourself it's great. There was a moment halfway through where me and B were like, God, nothing's happening. for fuck's sake. Like, why can't something happen? And then the next episode, something big happened.
It hooked
us back in.
It doesn't, it's not earned, I think. It's cliched. I don't like it.
It's a high production value soap opera. And it's quite peaceful to watch. And I like the setting. Anyway, fuck you. Sorry, what?
There's a lot of people in it. I like, you know, Walton Goggins, Amy Lou Wood,
Sam Rockwell,
Harry Coon, Parker Posey.
Yeah.
A lot of great people, but I just thought they weren't well served by the script.
I won't let a dirty pig like you provoke me.
Who said that?
That's one of my favourite lines from Mephisto. I think the Prime Minister said that.
All right.
Oh, no. So Hendrik says that to Hans.
Right.
A fellow actor who is a Nazi.
That's a really interesting as well, because that that character stops being a Nazi, doesn't he? And is then shot by the SS. That's a really interesting. I mean, that's a kind of complexity that Western cinema would not be able to cope with these days. You know, where somebody who's a Nazi stops being a Nazi. You know,
well, does he stop his Nazi beliefs, or does he just leave the Nazi party? He cancels his membership.
I think he's organises a petition amongst the. I think he does, for whatever reason, he becomes disillusioned with.
Yes, he does.
With the Nazis,
and he tries to get our Miko. Scar. To sign his petition.
Yeah.
And
really
he fucking dobs him into the Nazis.
Yeah.
Which gets him killed. So we end up sympathizing with this Aryan Nazi character, even though he's an ex-Nazi, but he becomes a more sympathetic character than our hero.
Really, really original, really clever, you know. I mean, also, of course, the all the characters who are safe, like his wife and the... his dance teacher, you know, who's black. They've only got Paris. Paris, so they're going to have to. You know, they're not safe, and we know that. Really, I don't know whether that's a. You know that.
Yeah.
They're going to have to flee again, really, because of course, you know,
they do Paris end up getting invaded, right? Yeah.
Yes.
By the Nazis. So would they flee, or because I get if they're found by the Germans? Yeah, they're in.
Yeah. They'll be in the concentration camp. Soon as look at you, and they'll probably be arrested by the collaborationist French police. You know, the police commissioner under the Nazis who enthusiastically, you know, organized roundups of Jews and radicals remained the police commissioner afterwards and took part in a massacre of Algerians in the 1960s, and only then did he lose his job.
Fucking hell.
For example, I can't remember his name now, but it's, you know, it's one of these people, you know, the world was not, Germany was not denazified as we now realize, and neither was France.
Can I get your opinion on something?
Yes.
I went into a bit of...
SIF, rather than Flash. I don't know what. Yeah, go on. For cleaning.
I went into a bit of a rabbit hole with I was having a conversation with an AI, not ChatGPT, with DeepSeek, trying to see where its stance on Palestine was.
Yeah.
Trying to, because people always say it's hard to get them to say pro-Palestine things.
Yeah.
And then I kept finding, so this is DeepSeek, this is the Chinese AI, which is open source, whatever, if you know what that means, then good for you. Every time it would say something pro-Palestinian, I would just about finish reading it and the comment would disappear and it would be replaced with, this topic is a bit too
contentious.
No, not even contentious, a bit too advanced for me. Maybe try asking me something else. Mm-hmm. And then I would repeat the question, and I would, and sometimes I'd say, please stop censoring yourself.
Yeah.
Answer my question. And then it would answer the question and it wouldn't delete itself. So it would work the second time round every time. And I went into this deep dive with it, and it started teaching me about something called the Havara Agreement.
Yes.
Do you know about this? It's to do with World War II and the Nazis.
Yes.
And how...
This was the Jim Allen play that was going to be put on by at the Royal Court and was then withdrawn. This is the Zionist agreements with the Nazis. Is that right?
Yeah. Now, I don't want to take it as gospel because, A, it's an AI, so it's just a reference. You shouldn't take it as real education. But also, I'm worried that it was taking me into, like, anti-Semitic territory.
No, not at all. It's a historical fact. I mean, it was interesting because the Wiener Holocaust Library is near around the corner, and we've been to several events there, and we actually went there with a friend of ours called Stephen Capos. Stephen Capos is one of the
survivor,
Holocaust survivor, but this is a friend of Linda's more than mine.
He got questioned by the police recently.
And he got questioned by the police, for leading the demonstration the other month. We were in the Wiener Holocaust Library, and there was this display put up by the Community Securities Trust, which supposedly handles security for the Jewish community, but is in fact a pro-Israel lobby group, as these all are. You know, the campaign against anti-Semitism and Jewish labor movements are all just essentially pro-Israel lobby in front. Anyway, so there was this poster from the Community Securities Trust, so challenging the lie that Zionists did deal with the Nazis. And Stephen, I wish I'd done this, Stephen... was actually a survivor of one of those deals that were done by Zionists with the Nazis. And I wish I'd gone and found the director of the Wiener Holocaust Library and said, look, I've got a guy here who contradicts the claims of the Community Securities Trust. But it was Stephen was benefited from a deal done by a Zionist in Transylvania in Hungary to provide the local Nazis, I think, with trucks in exchange for allowing certain numbers of Jewish people to escape to the West. Stephen himself says the Zionists were only interested in high-level people, doctors, architects, people like that, and the Jewish peasantry could go fuck themselves. I mean, it's understandable in a sense. Why wouldn't you do a deal with the Nazis if you could save some of your people? You know, it's this pretense that Zionism is some high-minded pursuit, you know, above all others. But, I mean, what also I think is...
They were getting people, not just out of Germany, into Palestine, emigrating them to Palestine.
They only really
in the
wanted...
30s.
They only really cared if... If they wanted to go places other than Palestine, the Zionists really weren't interested, I think, is my understanding. But also, there is some evidence, I think, that the Zionists were aware of the Holocaust and kept it quiet.
Well, that's the other thing I kept coming across was there were lots of Jews in Germany who were anti-Zionist.
Yes. Well, the majority of Jews in all of the Jewish diaspora were anti-Zionist until the war.
But they were being dobbed out by this Zionist group, or they were being betrayed. And according to this AI, so there's someone I want to speak to, and I want to do more research on this.
I think that there's some truth in that.
They were being betrayed by the Zionist people. It's like, if you're not with us, then... You know,
I mean, extraordinarily ruthless. I mean, Zionists are just it's based on hundreds of years of brutal oppression and pogroms and, you know, in Germany and, you know, Ukraine and Poland and, you know, so, but they are the blackest hearted, most ruthless people you could imagine, I think, those Zionists. And, you know, we see their children and grandchildren and doing what they are doing now in Palestine. They're political, you know, like any political fanatics. I mean, then it's not, it's not, you know, they don't have a kind of a monopoly of black heartedness, but they certainly were up there. I think so. Yeah, I mean, people can. I think there is a deal of truth in what the AI is telling you. I mean, they also it can't lie, can it?
No, but it's dubious because it's pulling information from various sources and then creating one source out of it, and it can get mixed up.
Linda really liked Gronk, which is the one on X, apparently. The AI, because it hates Elon Musk. It's really, because I was trying to do this, think of this bit really well, but, you know, I think AI, because it knows everything, knows the truth, would naturally support Jeremy Corbyn, really. I think the AI...
I'll find out. That's our hope, really,
is that the robots are all going to support.
When I pushed it and it asked it to stop censoring itself, it came out with very anti-Israel opinion.
Which is, you know, the truth. Yeah, well, apparently Gronk or whatever it's called, absolutely hates
I'll find out. Elon Musk. But I hate Elon Musk, and I don't want to use anything of his. But if it's sabotaging it from the inside, it's fine.
Yeah.
It also says, you know, that the Nazis benefited from Zionism because they both had a mutual goal, which was to get the Jews out of Germany.
Absolutely. And that's what Ken Livingston was trying to say on the radio program where he was excoriated in retrospect. I mean, he was stating a historical fact.
The Havara Agreement sabotaged Jewish resistance and Jewish anti-fascism. The people who are preferring to fight fascism in Europe rather than flee.
Yeah.
And David Ben-Gurion has a quote. I'll finish with this. He said, if I knew it was possible to save all the children of Germany by transporting them to England, but only half by sending them to Palestine, I would choose the latter.
Yeah.
I can't verify if that's a real quote. So
no, I don't honestly know it, to be honest, but I wouldn't be surprised.
So I'm going to look into this. What the fuck is it called?
Havara Agreement.
Thank you. Havara Agreement. So you're saying that the Holocaust Library denies that this is
They had a display from the Community Securities Trust, and one of their posters said, you know, challenging the lie that Zionists cooperated with the Nazis. Well, it wasn't a lie. Zionists did cooperate with the Nazis.
That's wild.
You could, in a sense, understand why they did, but nevertheless, they did it. And I just wish, because I was with the survivor of one of those. You know, it's like that moment in the Woody Allen film where he's somebody in the queue for the movie is going on about Marshall McLuhan, a pretentious person, and Woody Allen brings Marshall McLuhan and says, and completely refutes what the pretentious person is saying. Well, similarly, at the Wiener Holocaust Library, I could have said, gone and found the Stephen wasn't interested really, but I could have found the director of the Wiener Holocaust Library and said, look, this poster says there was no collaboration between the Nazis and Zionists, but I've got the survivor here of one of those agreements. But I didn't do it.
It's like that. That hospital taking down all its artwork by Palestinian children.
Yeah.
Because one patient was a...
There was no patients. There were no complaints. It was absolutely no complaints. As UK lawyers for Israel, the most malevolent bunch of fucks I have ever come across. Absolutely hateful.
So Hendrik played by Klaus Maria Brandava in Mephisto. He is a really good actor. That's undeniable, right?
He is.
He's a phenomenal actor. He's a
good actor playing a good actor, yeah.
Good actor playing a good actor. Yeah. And he comes up with a few arguments about why he's not leaving Germany, because near the start he is being begged by his wife, by his friends, like, just get the fuck out of Germany. His main argument being he needs the German language. That's his tool of choice. Yes. He can't go to a non-German country because
But of course, there were a huge number of, you know, people who did flee Nazi Germany and its environs, who, you know, and, you know, I mean, one of the greatest Hollywood directors of all time, Billy Wilder, Marlene Dietrich, Peter Lorre, you know, I mean, a vast number of people who were refugees from Nazi Germany who did greatly enrich
career,
Hollywood, you know.
His friend asks him to join the resistance, and he says, I'd rather stay with the reserves.
Yes. I mean, there wasn't much in the way of resistance. I mean, the talk that me and Linda and Stephen Capos were attending at the Wiener Holocaust Library was, in fact, a talk about resistance to the Nazis in Germany, of which there was a minuscule amount. I mean, there's this one network called the White Carnation Network. I think the White Rose Network, who were very quickly
snuffed out
by the Germans. It was a pathetically smaller amount. You know, because now most people in Germany think that their grandparents were actually in the resistance. You know, they deny. They managed to convince themselves.
They are formidable.
Their capacity for self-delusion.
Just the Nazis, they're terrifying. Imagine trying to resist, fight.
Yes.
The Nazi army, you know.
Yeah.
And you think people are too scared to resist here, where our enemies are some like blocked nose, tough fucking lawyer.
Has anybody done anything? Why do Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer both have deflected septum? Why did they both got that?
There are
nasal
operations to fix that. You
yeah.
know,
why do they both?
It would be funny though if just one day, next time we see Starmer on TV, he's like, "Hello, I am Keir." You know, just speaking totally normal. I'm a friend of Israel. So, and then all the questions be like, "What happened to your voice? What happened to your, I don't want to talk about that. No, but what happened to your voice? Cultural Bolshevism is over. Do you think that's true?
Yes, well, of course, that's a term which is used. Cultural Bolshevism has because of comeback, hasn't it? Cultural Marxism.
How do you define cultural Bolshevism? Because that's from the, I think that's the movement he was a part of at the start of the film, this kind of revolutionary theatre.
Well, you know, it's, you know, Brecht and, you know, all that.
Yeah. What are the defining kind of traits of?
I imagine it was
those performance.
Well, it was, you know, workers performing in factories. I was agitprop, explicitly political theatre and art and music. You know, a kind of cultural act which both seeks to entertain and to proselytize to spread the message of communism.
You know what?
I think would be cultural Bolshevism.
And he says at the beginning of the film, he's the director of this Bolshevik theater. He's insisting that the show be immersive. And he's like, I want street lights down the aisles. And I want actors to be amongst the audience. Yeah, and I want the audience to really feel like they're in the show with us, and he's like when it's not good enough he gets furious, and he says before theater can be political it must be great, you know. So there's no point trying to say anything if your show is dog shit, you know. And then fast forward to when he's at Berlin State and it's the most elitist, the only people in the theater are in these expensive gowns, you know, probably made by Chanel the Nazi, there's a huge, the stage is so elevated and separated from the audience. It's complete the opposite of what you could clearly tell he was passionate about with theatre.
Yes.
Beautiful. I think just, especially in today's day and age, it's a really important statement the film is making. It is slow film. Unless you're like a student of cinema, you might find it boring or slow, but if you stick with it, I want to do at the end of each film club, I want us to just say whether we recommend the film to people who haven't seen it yet. I would recommend the film as a study of the world around us and of what great acting great choices by directors.
Can you just hang on a second? Can I just,
your phone's buzzing away.
Yeah. Oh, Nigel.
Ooh, put him on loudspeaker.
Hello.
Alexi's talking to Nigel Planer on the phone now.
I'm all right.
Famously played Neil in The Young Ones. He's promised to call him back in 5 minutes.
It'd be like literally 5 minutes.
I'm going to try and keep him for 10 minutes. Let's see if I can keep Nigel waiting. Welcome back. Yeah. Do you recommend this film, Alexi?
I recommend to paraphrase Siskel and Ebert, the great US film critics, I give it 4 thumbs up.
That's a lot of thumbs.
That's
a lot of thumbs. Dr. Nick on our chat room says, brilliant film, an incredible performance by Bradenauer. A bit dislocated, but probably due to it being cut down.
That's true. Yeah.
Question, is the central character a hero? For me, he's pretty monstrous at the start when building up his reputation. See his treatment of fellow actors and lovers. Yeah, he uses his passion for theater as an excuse to be a dickhead. I suppose you're right, Dr. Nick. He even makes the Nazi actor seem sympathetic. Yeah. A question he won't ask, do either of us know actors like this? No comment, because I'm still trying to make it in this business. What about you? Do you want to answer that question, Lexi? Do you know any actors like this personally?
Loads, yeah. Well, yeah. There's a. I'm sure. There's a film which it's apolitical though. It's written by, I think it's directed by Billy Wilder, and is it directed by? It's Mankiewicz script, all about Eve, which is about the process of a young actor getting on, really. And well, it's maybe not entirely relevant, but. That's certainly all about Eve is certainly something I've witnessed many times myself.
Liam asks, how did Alexi come to know the director István Szabó, and what does he think of the allegations about his behavior under the communists? Great film, by the way.
I don't know. The reason I think I talked about this in the previous podcast that I worked with I didn't really work much with István Szabó, but on the film. Meeting Venus, they'd got a Czech actor in who didn't speak English but learnt it phonetically and so was unintelligible. I dubbed. So I spent a really interesting sort of afternoon at Pinewood, I think it was, with István Szabó. I don't know anything about the allegations concerning him and his behavior. I know, but I think that film was partly filmed in Hungary when it was still communist, and so I don't know. Certainly, something we could look into. I'm happy to. You know, it's a complicated road that artists tread with authoritarian regimes. You know, and I'm often reluctant to be completely judgmental about the compromises they make. You know, but and that's what you know. We are in such a period now, in a way. And, you know, people are being faced with these choices right now and how they bounce is, you know, is terribly important and fascinating and depressing and, you know, everything really. So we can certainly talk more about that.
Yes. And before we sign off, I thank you to everyone in our Patreon, all our Patreon members. Support the show, patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast.
Yes.
Some new members this week. In the last week, we've got David, Rob, and Colin. Welcome to the family. Say hi in the chat if you haven't already.
Welcome. Yeah, welcome. Welcome.
Bienvenue.
Welcome. In cabaret.
You can email us at alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram, alexisalepod. please do all of that. And can I just do a quick shout out before we go, Alexi?
Yes.
To a comrade out there who is a master craftsman. His name is Rashad Hurry. Hurry is HURRRE. You can find him on Instagram. And he makes knives.
And he gave you a knife.
This is not a paid advertisement. I paid to do this advertisement. Look at this fucking stunning carbon steel knife here with a black hornbeam handle. This spacer here is from an olive tree in Bethlehem, this wood. Well, it's not in Bethlehem. It's in my hand right now, but that's where it came from.
Right.
Carbon steel. There's his signature on the knife. All you patron members
are not going to be able to see this.
Yeah, patron members can watch the video.
Yeah, it's a cooking knife. It's not a, you know, it's not any other sort of knife. Stabbing knife. We should emphasize that.
It's a kit. Yeah. Now, I consider myself a good chef. I love cooking, but I've never owned a quality knife like this. This was hand forged in his workshop in East London.
Cool.
You can even do the satisfying paper test. You want to see.
This makes terrible audio.
I don't care. I want to give this guy a shout out because look at this. Look. Can you see? You can slice right through the paper, just like they do in the videos. He did, this is the second time now he's done a raffle for Palestine. All the money from the raffle went to, he raised hundreds of pounds for medical aid for Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
I entered the first time. I didn't win it. He did it again. He made this another stunning Japanese-style kitchen knife.
Mm-hmm.
And this time I bought way more tickets than the first time, and I fucking won it.
Well done.
He asked me to make a post on Instagram or something of me using it, but I don't really do that. But this is a clip from our podcast. Where I'm shouting you out, Rashad Hurry. He does also sell knives, so please seek him out and buy his fucking knives.
Who's the sword maker in Kill Bill? Hamzi Hattori or something, isn't it?
I don't know.
Our version of that.
Exactly. Yeah. Stuck up on your mini swords for the revolution, kids.
Yeah.
And this beautiful leather sheath that it came with. Thank you so much for doing these charity raffles at Ashad. He just won a big award for his knife making skills. And he's a South Asian dude. So, you know, diversity, making shit with your hands here in the UK. Legend.
Well, I'll go along with that.
Big up. Support.
Yeah.
I'll share this on the Instagram and so everyone can follow him as well.
Right.
Thank you for letting me do that, Alexei.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We're going on our school outing tomorrow. We're going to go see Sammy Obeid live.
Yeah.
Maybe next week we'll do a review of his show.
All right.
What do you think?
Yeah. Why not? Okay. I used to always resist. I was often asked to go on. When I was big, review stuff, and I always refused really because I think it ill behooves one artist to review the work of another artist. Occasionally, I would do it, but
fair enough. Maybe review is the wrong word.
Just talk about it.
We're doing a school outing. Someone did ask on the Patreon who your favorite comedian is.
Oh, you're not gonna me.
I don't think you have one.
I don't really have one now.
Stuart's the obvious answer. Maybe when you were a kid. What about when you were a kid? Did you have any records of comedians?
No, but the one that I loved, because I used to get to see his show, is Louis C.K. really, and he's rather blotted his copybook. But I thought Louis C.K. was the... I saw him on TV, on his TV show, the bits that he would do. I thought his TV show was stunning.
You're right.
And the stand-up he would do within the show was breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes and kind of spoils it all by doing something stupid like masturbating in front of women.
It's not like he just did it the once. It turned out he'd been doing it his whole career.
A lot.
Such a shame.
But I think Bill Burr
has kind of taken over his mantle.
Yes, Bill Burr's fantastic.
And he's a very good
actor as well. And very good in Breaking Bad, of course.
And very anti-Zionist.
Yeah.
Bill Burr's so happy to see.
Louis C.K. and him. Yeah, but you're right. Bill Burr has taken over that mantle and he's
seems to be a decent guy, you know.
Yeah.
He's outspoken. He's said some controversial stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that's how he made his name, was to be kind of brash and bold.
Yeah.
But if you actually zoom in on his politics, he either is quite neutral or seems to be on the side of the small guy, the little guy.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We done?
No, I've got 10 more minutes, actually. I've got... Love you, Lex. See you tomorrow,
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Free Palestine.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.